If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What they say.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Today we are diving straight into the Delphi case, part of the Delphi case that's been hiding in plain sight for years, hiding if you want to call it that, the depositions, the filings, the sworn testimony, and the internal investigative record that was never part of the polished public narrative. And I'm going to say this bluntly because there's no other way to say it. The picture these depositions paint is not one of a cohesive investigation that followed the evidence. It's the picture of an investigation fighting itself, contradicting itself, and stumbling through major decisions as if no one was steering the helm. We're not talking about minor mistakes. We're talking about the FBI possibly being kicked out or not, depending on which investigator you ask. We're talking about the behavioral analysis unit setting up a flare about Nordic beliefs, ritualistic staging, symbolic indicators, only for the entire assessment to vanish from the internal record. We're talking about witness statements reshaped into something unrecognizable. When they hit the search warrant affidavit, we're talking about major leads in this case on possible third-party suspects, just brushed aside with no further action. Even after bizarre self-incriminating statements, we're talking about sticks left at the crime scene for days, a bullet with zero field documentation, and experts brought in 7 years too late to analyze photographs instead of evidence. This isn't fringe speculation. These aren't internet fantasies. This is what investigators themselves said under oath in black and white. And the only question now is what any of this means for Richard Allen, for the appeal, and for the integrity of the case itself. Here to help us dissect all of this, Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Bob, let's dive into this shit show as it continues along. The shit tracks. Two lead investigators, two opposite sworn statements about whether the FBI was removed from the case. One says they were kicked out. The other says, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, just take us into this cesspool of confusion.
Yeah, so what we're talking about in terms of the new evidence, if you out there in the audience aren't aware, during the case itself, actually pre-trial, but before any hearings were conducted, there was this thing called a Franks motion that was filed by the defense, and the Franks motion is essentially saying, in layperson's terms, that when they went in to get the warrant, the arrest warrant and or the search warrant, that there were misrepresentations or omissions that were made or straight up lies that were made by law enforcement in order to secure that particular warrant. Okay, so the defense filed it. It's a massive filing. It was like 136 pages. And with that, there was a ton of exhibits that were attached. Okay, so once that thing was resolved, if you want to call it that, even though there was never actually a hearing on it, but she did have a hearing on the third party culprit stuff, which is kind of where the Franks memo lived in terms of the information that it put out to the public, ultimately what ends up happening is that Allen's convicted and there's an appeal being processed right now. They're preparing the appellate briefs, and Allen's appellate lawyers are saying, look, we don't have the exhibits for this huge Franks memo. We need them. Because for whatever reason, the clerk, Jody Williams, who happens to be Judge Gull's clerk, didn't supply those exhibits along with the record when she prepared it for the appeal. Okay. So the defense appellate attorneys go and say, hey, we need these. You know, like you need these. We need them to prepare the brief, and you, the appellate court, need them so that you have a complete record in front of you. And at that point, the appellate court turns around and says, okay, here's the deal. We've been asking you to get the record complete so that we can move along with this appeal. And they gave Williams and Gull 20 days to get the thing on record, okay, mm-hmm. make to perfect the appellate record. So that's what dropped. So they're not new in the sense like it's unearthed evidence that came out of nowhere. It's the evidence, as the defense sees it, that was attached as exhibits to the Franks memo. However, mm-hmm. in terms of us seeing it, the public, it's all new. So we didn't see all this stuff. So we're kind of getting a peek behind the curtain. We're kind of getting a vision of what the defense was seeing when they started digging into things. And, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of shocking stuff out there. And starting with kind of your first point, Tony, with, you know, why were the feds disposed of in this case? And I'll tell you, Doug Carter got on the stand and, I mean, he testified to it at trial that he told the FBI, no, we're good. Thanks. Thanks, but no thanks.
Can you just turn them away like that? Can you just go, get lost, buddy. It's not your jurisdiction.
Yeah. I mean, apparently.
Yeah.
Because he did. You know, they dipped out of the case.
Why would you?
Manpower. You know,
why would you? And how common is that to have happen? Especially when you're talking about, and maybe it's more common than I'm aware of. When we're talking a smaller jurisdiction here, like Delphi, they don't have a lot of resources. So the FBI being like, hey, we're going to help you. We can really dig in here. We can give you these resources that you don't have. How common is it that small jurisdictions turn that sort of thing away? Maybe it is for the wrong reasons, which I feel like it is here. Why did they do that in this case?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like that question of why does it seem like they're protecting a pedophile in Spencer? I mean, there is no good answer. And the only answer that you can come up with is nefarious.
Yeah.
Like you're talking about the Unified Command, which is this little, you know, kind of internal investigation team that they put together, which was comprised of a bunch of guys that had never investigated anything like this. Mm-hmm. like nothing. Like
the title, Unified Command.
Unified Command. Command. Yeah.
Yeah.
So ultimately they end
Unified.
Up.
Unified.
Thanks, Todd.
That's me.
Oh, thanks, Tone. Ultimately, why they did it is inexplicable. I mean, you're talking about the feds, who are obviously going to have way more experience. They're going to have way more resources. They're going to have way better technology. Mm-hmm. Like, why you wouldn't want them involved if they're willing to do it is inexplicable to me, mm-hmm. you know, and this is deeper into the investigation. I think it's in like 2019. It's like 2 years mm-hmm. in, you know? So I wish I had a better answer. I simply don't know. And I cannot think of a good reason as to why. You know, it's like you're talking about these guys. I don't want to call them a bunch of Barney Fifes, but to me, from the outside looking in, they look like a bunch of Barney Fifes.
I was just going to ask about that, because are all cases as confusing and jumbled behind the scenes, and maybe we just don't see it? And when it all comes out into trial, it is a nice, neat package. Are they this disorganized behind the scenes all the time, or is this an extraordinary case?
No, well, I think that, you know, you're dealing with human beings, and human right. beings make mistakes, and you know, you're going to have cops when you've got multiple, especially if there's multiple agencies involved. You know, you're going to have individuals that are have their own thoughts on the case. They're going to have ideas that the investigation should go one way, and another guy's going to say, well, I don't think that's it. And if that guy ranks higher than the guy who thinks it should go one way, that guy who's the lower ranking guy, his theory of the way the investigation should go is not going to be adhered to, and it's not going to be taken seriously, which is exactly what happened here. I happen to be friends with one of the guys who was originally on this case as an investigator with the Carroll County Sheriff's Department, and he was a high ranking deputy sheriff in there. And, you know, he was a guy who had said, look, I think this is like we're over our skis on this one. Like we need help. We need help from qualified agencies that have done this type of investigation before, because we're going to fuck it up. And ultimately, he ends up leaving the sheriff's department, whether it was by hook or by crook is hard to know. He ended up suing, and I think there was a settlement, but, you know, he was very much of the mindset that they needed help because they just could not do this because they weren't equipped and they didn't have the experience to do it. So in that case, you know, I mean,
that's a big piece of this. Like right at the beginning, you have that sort of behavior going on. You have someone saying exactly what you just said. We're in over our heads on this. We need a little bit of help. Well, we don't. And however that went down, it ends in a lawsuit and he leaves. Obviously, it probably had something to do with this. At least that would be the tea leaves if we're going to read them, in my opinion. So you have this already. We see this track record of are these blinders that these guys had on in this case? Because this is the thing that we always look at in here. And now that we're seeing some of these depositions and such, we're always trying to figure out, is it incompetence or is there something trying to be covered up here? Because the two can look very, very similar. Incompetence quite often can look very nefarious, but sometimes people are just not the brightest or they're just not that experienced. They don't have reps in a certain area, and what they may think they should do turns out to be probably the worst idea imaginable. When you started looking at some of these depositions, Bob, what was your takeaway? What were some of the key pieces that had stood out to you?
I mean, really, Jerry Holman's was probably the most disturbing, you know, and Jerry Holman was really the lead dude on this thing. You know, I mean, if anybody's watched any of the Allen interrogations, and there's two of them, you know, it's Jerry Holman that's the cop who's interrogating him in the second one, which is, you know, the more disturbing of the two. And that is ultimately where, you know, Rick Allen, after that interview, never saw the light of day again. You know, he was taken into custody, and he never left that police department. When they were told to come over to that police department under the guise that they were coming to pick up their car that they had taken to, you know, process. So, you know, he ends up going there. But, you know, the Holman thing to me is just unbelievable.
What, you know, because go into that for those who haven't seen the deposition. Just give us your synopsis of it.
I mean, to me, you're hearing from a cop who's essentially, in a nutshell, Tony, talking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, and it's, you know, because they're asking him specific questions. And I think Baldwin was the one doing the questioning, but it could have been Rosie. I can't remember at this point. But, you know, it's just like they're really kind of diving into the investigation. And what becomes apparent throughout this deposition is that they really had no idea. You know, they initially, and for a long, long time, they believed that this was multiple people had committed this crime, and then they didn't. And, you know, in terms of the questioning about the third-party culprit stuff, you know, it's just, you know, it's hard to pinpoint one thing without me having it in front of me. Yeah. But the whole thing, just the way that it reads, you really get an idea that, you know, they really did nail a square peg into a round hole in terms of Richard Allen in this case. You know, once they landed on him as the guy, you know, and once they decided, okay, well, he put himself out there, And, you know, we got this on spent casing that we think that we'll be able to go into court and say matches his weapon. That's as good as it's going to get for us. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, that's how this thing felt all along to me, you know, and when we start getting into the exhibits with this Franks thing, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it more, but when you look at the things that three very qualified cops, longtime cops that continue to investigate, and we're talking about Ferency, Click, and Murphy, the guys who were continuing kind of on the Norse paganism type theme that this, you know, was something that was going on. And you look at what the evidence that they developed and, you know, for Holman and his depth to be saying, well, you know, Holder had an alibi. He has an alibi for a time frame that you're claiming that you think this time that the crimes took place. You know, you know what I mean? Like, the kidnapping of the girls could have taken place at one time, and the homicides could have taken place at any time prior to when they're discovered the next day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for them to be acting as if it all happened contemporaneously, they're kidnapped. As soon as they get down there, they cross this river. They're all soaking wet. It's, you know, 3.5 feet high. You know, Alan, who's, you know, 5'4", 5'5", would be, you know, up to his high chest, somehow controlling two girls. He gets over there and then kills them both. That all happens kind of like one thing after another. Doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
No, I mean, it's anybody. Almost like if it were to be, you know, you watch like a situation comedy and sometimes they get the piano music moving and then it turns into this very, you know, funny physical comedy routine that goes on for, you know, an extended period of time. You're like that's all. I mean, this is a horrible situation, but that's almost what you'd be talking about is just like, oh, and this happened. And then it's like all improv to work this certain way and it's going to do this. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make any sort of logical sense. What's your take here? Because the thing that was talked about early on, and then obviously it never got it into the trial, is the Odinism. And when we first heard about it way back, I remember it. We're like, what the hell? Huh? Is this real? But this is actually something the FBI's behavioral analysis unit brought into the picture we're learning about. The behavioral analysis isn't just like kind of like, well, let's spin the magic eight ball. Let's see here. Odinism today is what we got. Looks like, kids, it might be Odinism. No, I mean, they looked into this. They found experts to talk to. There's actually quite a bit, as crazy as this shit sounds. There's quite a bit of evidence that points to at least somebody or some peoples are into this over there. No, it may not be quite eyes wide shut level shit, but somebody likes to do some of this stuff in some way, shape, or form, and they're practicing it in some way, shapes, or forms. At least that's what it appears.
Yeah, it, without question. And, you know, if you were able to go back in a time machine, if you're the defense, in terms of making sure that the wording was more carefully put out to the public in terms of what they thought might have occurred here. I think that when they kind of worded that it was a ritual sacrifice, that was a thing that I think made people go to the place like, okay, well, that's fucking crazy.
You went to satanic panic.
Right. Because it didn't have to be that. And I don't think that it was that. I think it's exactly what you said, that you may have had a couple, two, three guys that were into this kind of shit, and that for whatever reason the homicides took place, that it wasn't because of a sacrifice to the gods, but that it, you know, whatever it was, whatever the true motive was, and that part of their belief system is what accounts for the fact that they left these sticks in this, you know, in these particular arrangements, you know what I'm saying? So because it's a whole different thing to think that they went out there and, you know, with the express intent goal of finding two girls and, you know, they're going to sacrifice them for a specific religious purpose. Whereas whatever may have happened here, whatever the true motive was, you know, that they're basically just going out there. And then once the deed was done in terms of what kind of their belief system is, that they decide, okay, well, you know, maybe we feel bad about it. Maybe, you know, whatever the case may be, whatever their thought process is, which is really why the defense's expert Perlmutter, who didn't get to testify at trial, was really fascinating, because cops, and one of the things that she was explaining is that cops are not taught to investigate in kind of, you know, with a magical thought process. And I know that that's kind of a corny sounding thing, but magical thought is like in real world application. If you pray, you know, to
magical thinking.
Yeah. Magical thinking. And you pray and you're hoping that that prayer is going to come true. Mm-hmm. That's magical thought. So it's not necessarily magic like wizards and shit. Right. It's just thinking that something out there. So, you know, and everybody has their own conception of what that is personally. You know what I'm saying? So, but cops aren't trained to think in that way in terms of when they're looking at a crime scene. So when they brought the BAU in, they're looking at it and they're like, okay, this is unusual, which was enough for them to think, okay, yeah, this does have some elements of what appears to be Norse paganism. You know, like there's some Odinism type, you know, like the runes, what appear to be runes are clearly something that we think that this could be a part of it. I mean, if you watched the first season of True Detective, I mean, which I think was out right around the same fucking time. Like, you know, it had that kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know, so ultimately I'm going to trust the BAU more than I'm going to trust Unified Command in terms of what their initial assessment was.
Yeah. Unified Command.
So, you know, again, everything goes back to why are they kicking the feds out of the party? You know, it always goes back to that question for me. And, you know, there's the entire thing with the Purdue professor, Turco, which, you know, again, if you followed the case, you're aware that when the defense uncovered all these different things that were stuck randomly in the 15 terabytes of discovery, you know, so as to hide them, like they weren't in one cohesive package, like, oh, here's the Odinism stuff, all in one nice, neat package. It was all stuck around like needles in a haystack. Mm-hmm. So when they end up uncovering these things piecemeal and they start looking at it and they're like, holy shit, like what is going on here? And like, why did this thing go away? Why did this leg of the investigation dry up? You know, and ultimately you can't help but wonder exactly why that took place. Because when they then go, because initially Unified Command's like, okay, there is something weird about this scene. So they go to this Purdue professor, who this is his field, and they say, okay, here's the crime scene photos, man. Like, did you notice anything strange about this? And he's like, well, it certainly seems to have, you know, some telltale signs of what looks to be some kind of Norse paganism ideology going on. He's like, I'm certainly going to, I'm not going to say that it doesn't. So you've got this Purdue professor who they then, when they decide that they're going to take a different path, okay, they disappear that guy, at least in terms of him being any part of the investigation or that they consulted with him. So when the defense is asking, hey, who was this Purdue professor that you went to? And that's the whole thing where they're playing the game. Oh, we don't know. We forget what his name was.
Right.
Like the whole thing. And then ultimately there's emails going back between Baldwin, who's one of the defense attorneys, and McClelland, who's the prosecutor, and McClelland's telling him, oh yeah, you know, I asked those guys and you know, they're kind of the mindset that we'll never be able to figure it out who this guy was. And, you know, so ultimately the defense keeps pressuring them on this point. And look, dude, like there's not going to be that many people at Purdue that are professors that are in that department that are going to be teaching this kind of shit. They were going to figure out who the fuck it was.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like the defense investigator would eventually have gone over there and said, okay, which one of you guys talked to Unified Command? which one of you guys talked to the, you know, the Carroll County Sheriff's Department? Like who? You know, and out of the three people in that department, one of them said, "Oh yeah, it was me." So, like, ultimately, you know, McClellan's still sending out emails saying that they're not going to know, and then the interim they end up finding out through Holman's deposition that they knew who it was and they had told McClellan. So
surprise.
It's like like the kind of shit that was going on is all the thing that happens, like all the things that happen that make you doubt this conviction so vehemently, you know? I mean, for me at least.
There are so many reasons in the Delphi murders case to question what reality is, what's going on. We're talking with Bob Mata, defense attorney and host of the podcast Defense Diaries, about all of this as more and more documents have begun to come to light, depositions of the investigators breaking down so many of the claims that were made, so many of the ways this was steered internally, one person saying this, another saying that, sometimes not seemingly knowing what the other one is saying. One of the big pieces in this case, Bob, as we continue to break it down, is some of the early testimony. Obviously, there is the whole, oh, we accidentally taped over our DVR with old episodes of the Golden Girls or whatever they did when they taped over their DVR of interviews with early suspects. Like, damn, we needed more Blanche. But what we have here in some of these interviews and some of these depositions, what we're learning about, and we've known for quite some time, but makes zero sense to the public when they start paying attention to this, is someone like Brad Holder, who on his Facebook page is allegedly, I mean, I've seen it. I mean, allegedly he has, it looks like people are acting out this murder scene. I don't know any other way to put it. Like two girls laying on the ground with the sticks on them. You have his buddy Elvis Fields allegedly making this statement, "If my spit is found on the girls, would I still be in trouble?" And these sort of things, they seem like they might be of some sort of relevance to a murder investigation. What say you?
You'd think.
Yeah, I mean, to me.
First of all, who asks a question like that? I mean, is that something that you say when you're at lunch with your buddies? I mean, how do you even come up with a question like that?
It's even worse than that. It's like, so they had taken this Elvis Fields guy, and it's Kevin Murphy, who's, again, one of those three cops that was investigating this particular, you know, potential lead in terms of Odinism. You know, Norse paganism, and they take him in, they interview him. So, and Murphy's driving him back to his trailer park. Okay. And like, so Elvis Fields he's out of the car. Murph's like, "Okay, thanks, man. You know, we'll be in touch." And, you know, he starts walking away and he turns around and he goes back to the car. So he's out of the vehicle. And that's when he says this thing. He says, "Hey, can I ask you a question?" He's like, "So if my spit is found on one of the girls, but I have an explanation, you know, am I good? Am I in trouble?"
What the hell? And
dude, I don't know. People wonder why I've just been like, my head's been exploding about this case for 2+ years. It's like all the, like, how do you discount that? I don't want to hear people saying, "Oh, well, Fields has a super low IQ." Yeah, I don't give a fuck. Like, that would explain how stupid he has to be in order to go up to a cop and ask him that stupid ass question. You know what I mean? Like, to me, that's a perfect explanation as to why he would have done that.
Why are you spitting on the body of a dead girl? And why is that like just a walk away moment?
Oh, wait, I forgot. Hang on a second before I go.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and beyond that, it's not just what he said to Kevin Murphy. It's what he said to his sisters. Like, right after the crimes took place, you know, he goes home and he's like, "Oh," he's like, "I'm finally a part of something. I'm finally a part. I've got brothers now. I'm like, you know, like, I did this thing." And, you know, he confesses to his sister, and his sister is so disturbed by it that she reaches out to law enforcement. She's like, "Well, you know, my brother has basically confessed to being a part of these crimes." They bring her in order to give her a polygraph. And the polygraph is to determine whether or not she is being truthful about what her brother said to her. And the polygraph comes back. And again, polygraphs are just tools, mm-hmm. but law enforcement uses them in order to you know, be able to try to indicate if there's some kind of deception going on. And they found that she was being truthful, you know, that her brother did, in fact, say this shit to her. So you compile that along with the thing that went on with Murphy. And I just don't see how you're able to ignore it in such a way, you know. And they're like, oh, well, his phone was at the house. Well, his phone was off for 10 hours. You know, his alibi that he was out at this hospital with Ron Abramson is cannot be verified. Like everything that they say that they did to kind of clear these guys is all bullshit. Yeah. When you go back to Brad Holder, and you know, he's like, well, I was at work. Okay, well, so what? You know, you're at work until whatever, 4 o'clock or 2:30, sometime, I forget what the time is, but it's sometime in that time frame, right? And that doesn't mean that the girls weren't picked up by somebody else in that crew if they're involved. You know, yeah. you have to believe that the state's timeline is the correct timeline. And I just don't. I don't think that that's the correct. The concept, and I've been out to the trails, right? Mm-hmm. I went out there because I was there for all the trial. Yeah. So obviously, you know, I went out and spent quite a bit of time on the trails. And it's a very serene place. You know, now it's got that kind of haunted feeling, obviously, because we know what happened there. But, you know, I'm out there and I was out there with my wife and like she was taking a different path. And I walked down to the bridge. Okay. And now the way that it's currently situated is they finally closed it off in the sense that they built like a banister, like a railing that stops. So it leads you out to where you used to be able to walk out on the bridge if you like walked around the barricade that they had. That's yeah. how all the kids used to continually walk over that thing. And so I went out there, and Tony and Stacy, the thing that was so evident to me is that there you can hear everything out there. I was standing out there and there was no one else out there. Okay. And there was a small, I don't even know what it was. It sounded like I was standing right next to it, but up, if you look up to, and this is at the north end of the bridge. If you look up, there's like the kind of like a berm that goes up like from the north mm-hmm. side where you could walk up and then you're on the other side of Deer Creek. And that's how you would get down to Ron Logan's property without crossing the creek. So mm-hmm. I'm looking up in that area because I can hear an animal moving around. Whether it's a squirrel or a deer, whether yeah. it's big or small, I don't know, but I hear it as clear as day. My point being that with the amount of people that were out there down in that area around the time that the state is claiming, for no one to have heard anything in terms of two girls being taken by gunpoint across a creek and then the homicide taking place, like, do you think that one of the girls, while the other one is being unalived, would just be sitting there quietly while the killer is slitting her throat?
I mean, because they didn't get killed there, probably.
Well, right. I mean, the concept that no one heard anything in terms of
insane. And you got to think of that. That's a very good point to make. I'm thinking of that right now because we're getting into fall and autumn and winter and all that. And there's a dramatic difference outside on a mm-hmm. walking trail in
leaves
winter
crunching.
or summer. When you have all the leaves and the foliage is there, there's a lot of noise that's going on. When it's quiet and nothing's rustling in the trees, you can hear almost anything. You're exactly right. Yep. And this was a day like that. This was a setting like that where, yeah, you don't know if that's, I mean, sometimes a chipmunk sounds like it's a boar. And like, yeah. oh God, it's just a chipmunk that's rustling right. around. But yes, the sound is a huge thing. And you're exactly right. You're going to control these two girls. You're going to murder them. And then somehow they're going to be like completely clean after the murders too, because that's naturally how that happens with no blood around. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. That's where it obviously makes a lot more sense that they were killed elsewhere and then their bodies were drugged back out there, probably by more than one person. But again, none of it, all these things, somehow they tried to fit that square peg into that round hole with Richard Allen, despite all of this? Were they just hoping that no one would ever pay attention to this and they could just kind of keep going? Is this just kind of how a lot of small town cases work, where eventually, like, most never end up paying attention to it and you can just kind of shuffle them along? But now we're in a very different landscape where there's gazillions of us out there that have nothing better to do than to check each other's work or check the work of small towns and their law enforcement and their handling of cases. And they weren't anticipating having their work checked.
I mean, they could have thought that initially. You know, they're like, oh, we're just this little small town in Indiana, rural Indiana. And, you know, but like they had to know in short order, like once they decided to release the bridge guy, that little clip of the bridge guy in the picture. And once the national media picked up on it and once, you know, they decided to do a podcast about it, they had to know that it was becoming a high profile case.
Yeah.
Pretty early on.
And why the bridge guy video too, the video they released was edited. The sound isn't in the right place.
I was sitting at the trial, right? I've been waiting like the rest of the world to watch these videos. And you knew that we were coming to that point in the trial, and McClelland talks about, okay, we're going to play this video. I'm like, oh my God, we're finally going to see this 43, 46 seconds, whatever it is. And so I'm sitting there like on the edge of my seat. You know, we're in a relatively small courtroom. There's one large monitor that they had kind of towards the window side of the courtroom. Okay. So you've got the jury box over to what would have been my right. And then this monitor over to the left. And I had pretty decent seats. I was like third row. So like, you know, so I'm sitting there and you're trying to take it all in, right? In, you know, this 40 seconds in time. And when I'm initially watching it, it didn't seem. And so when he says that he's going to show the video, he claims that he's showing the original video first, that the one that wasn't enhanced. Okay, so I'm sitting there watching it. And when I'm watching that the first time, I don't see Bridge Guy. Okay, like when I'm watching it. Now, does that mean that he wasn't there? I don't know. I mean, it's like clearly at some point the guy appears, but in that original video, I don't see him. Is it because I'm trying to look at everything and take everything? I don't know. It was the fastest 40 seconds of my life. Like when I walked out of the courtroom, because we took a break after it, I'm like, I was asking other people, I'm like, was that the full like 40 whatever seconds? And some people were like, nah, it couldn't have been. It was too fast. And some people were like, yeah, well, that was it. I was timing it. So I'm like, you know, but you're trying to look and hear everything that you can when you're watching it in that time. So I'm like, ah, oh, man, I didn't see the dude. Did you see the guy? And like various people were like, no, I didn't see him either. So I'm like, okay, that's not just me. Like, because I don't want people saying, oh, well, like Bob Mata thinks he's innocent, so he didn't say. No, like I just didn't see him. So the next video that they show is the enhanced. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in that video, you clearly see him. Now, I don't know what they did, because they didn't put on the kind of like foundational evidence that I would have expected to explain the process of what they did exactly to that video to enhance it in such a way that it looks so drastically different to me. So, and then they show a third version, which they say was enhanced and stabilized, which I, again, there was no real questioning by the defense in terms or any kind of foundation laid by the prosecution as to how this occurred. Like what process did you use in order to get to this? They said some shit, like you go back to the trial transcripts and see what he says. It's like the equivalent to nothing.
Well, you know, we stabilized it. So, you know, we held it real good. Like it was nothing.
Yeah.
It wasn't kind of the technical thing that you would hope to hear in terms of like how you were able to produce this video, which again, you know, the people that have all the serious doubts about this conviction, they look at those types of things and they're like, you know, that's why people are like, oh, well, you know, was this thing, was it tampered with? You know, did it come from the actual phone? Where did this video, you know, like that creates all that kind of doubt when they're not putting forth the process in which they were able to get this thing looking the way that it did. So, you know, ultimately, you know, that video, man, is like just one of those things where I'll never understand how they were able to make it seem the way that it seemed in terms of kind of the way that, like, there was one portion of it where it seemed like from the original to where I'm watching the enhanced and stabilized thing, that, like, I can see, it's almost as if they were able to access, like, the back camera. Like, so, you know what I'm saying? Like, that they were able to access things that you weren't seeing on the original video, but that was being recorded by, like, I don't know, man. It just, it looks so different.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's extended, and where the sound drops of the down the hill is not where it drops in that little snippet that they originally placed. The sound is different, and they made it so the sound would be at a different place, so it looks a lot more ominous. When I watched that video, one of the newer extended cuts of it, I don't get a real ominous feeling from the guy at all. Because the girls, if we watch it, it's they're trying to figure out, you're clearly talking about how to get underneath the bridge before the guy even gets there. Yep. They're wanting to go down the hill. They are the ones that want to go down the hill. So they're kind of fumbling around. The guy gets close enough. If you see two kids and they're trying to figure out a path to get somewhere, and you know the path, I don't think it's insane to be like, down the hill. Like, it's kind of point. Like, the path's right there. That's kind of what I got out of it. If I saw that and I didn't know anything that happened, I would not have necessarily said, a murder took place immediately after this. It just doesn't have that sort of a vibe to it when presented in its full context. And if it was such a nefarious, scary video, then why the hell did we only see 3 seconds of it up until until after you got Richard Allen convicted?
Context is everything, right?
Yeah, and we look at the whole damn thing, and it's like, this is nothing.
Right.
Like, there's nothing to this.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's the lack of context in terms of putting out that little teeny clip is what made it so ominous.
Yeah,
you don't have the entire video. And, you know, for me, like, who the hell is Libby talking to? In that portion of the video where she's like, you go down right here. You know, like, this is like, there's no path. Like, this is where you go. You know, like, who is she talking to? Kind of almost in a whisper. You know what I'm saying? It's like, to me, like, I just don't know if there's somebody else behind her, because we know that Abby's not to her at that point, you know, because then she swings the camera back around and that's when you see Abby come to, like, run past her.
To herself, you know, with a camera and a mic. That's kind of what I got out of it. I felt like she was just kind of murmuring to herself and there's a mic in front of her.
And she's recording it, because that's what that generation does now. They document everything and they narrate it. That's
basically narrating her life is kind of what I got out of it.
So it's possible. It's kind of TikTok culture, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was it TikTok culture in 2017, though?
True.
It was starting.
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, Snapchat culture.
Yeah, I mean, people are narrating stuff. We certainly had YouTube. People are narrating things at that.
Yeah.
I didn't find that part weird. I found that to be just she's making a video and kind of chatting to herself.
Yeah, but you're not taking into consideration. So if I'm to agree with your premise there, T, which I'm apt to do, but that also bolsters your claim that there didn't seem anything to be nefarious about the guy, because when she's doing that, right? Like, like she would have presumably seen the guy at that point when she's turning around and filming that and saying, you know, this is the path that we go down, or whatever she says, something to that effect. So, you know, I mean, that would seem to indicate that if she is just continuing to kind of narrate, you know, oh, this is where we're at, this is what we're doing, you know, this is the path that we would go down, then I think that supports your position that they weren't thinking anything of that guy in terms of him being a threat. You know, the other part of it that you just cannot explain, okay, which is the 207 picture, right, of Abby on the bridge that's presumably taken by Libby, however that picture was never found on her phone, not in her picture cache, and on the Snapchat cache, nowhere. They couldn't find that phone. It came from the internet, and it's that picture of Abby with the entirety of the bridge behind her,
mm-hmm.
all the way to the south. You can see all the way to the end, and there's nobody there. So, you know, like, I have always been of the mindset that this dude ended up walking from the north end past them and then turned around. And that because, like, I don't know how you explain that person just doesn't exist now. Because if you're out there, I mean, there's I wish I could have gotten out onto the bridge because I would have taken measurements. I really wanted to take measurements in terms of, like, what the distance between the railroad ties was, you know, but it's a scary bridge to cross.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the type of bridge that you're just walking, you know.
No, there's dangers. Thing. Yes.
Yes. It's a very, very scary proposition. And especially if you're, you know, the older you get in life, the scarier shit becomes. Like, especially a bridge that's 100+ feet off, you know, above a creek, yeah. You know, like, when you're across, like, old people are going to be like, oh shit, man, this is pretty terrifying.
Gone this far, yeah. This ain't worth it.
Yeah. Right. You know? So I don't know, man. It's like that picture of Abby on the bridge with nobody behind her in conjunction with the video, it does not make sense to me in terms of what their theory is. And I'm talking about the state's theory of the case.
It would be a great setting for Robert Stack in his trench coat to be walking across the bridge on.
Nice.
And
so,
and then all of a sudden he trips visual. And that's the end of Unsolved Mysteries forever.
Right.
It's like, oh, Robert Stack's gone. What are we looking at in the comments, Stacey, on some of this?
Lots of stuff. Our comment section today is absolutely on fire, and I want to thank everybody for their amazing comments. Scrolling back, somebody brought up, is it Greg Ferency?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was an interesting comment. I'm so sorry. I can't remember who said it because our comments are just blowing up today. It's way back there. But talking about that link as well, Greg Ferency died, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
He was murdered. Yeah.
Outside a courthouse?
A federal building. Yeah.
Okay. Forgive me if my memory is cloudy, but he could have testified to what he knew, right?
Well, of course. I mean, had she?
Do you think it was? He was murdered. It was not a targeted shooting. But
well,
there's so many deaths around this case.
Whether or not it was targeted is hard to say. I don't know that. The problem is that Ferency, but, you know, he's deceased. Rest in peace to Greg Ferency, who by all accounts was an excellent law enforcement officer. But you still had Todd Click and you had Kevin Murphy that would have been available to testify. They were all three working as a team together, you know, which is where this appeal, how much they're going to dive into the third party culprit defense not being allowed at trial. I'm hoping mm-hmm. that they're going to be diving into it pretty substantially. But those two guys could have testified. They could have testified as to what Ferency had uncovered in his own investigation, you know, under the collective knowledge doctrine. So, like, that would have been able to come in.
Okay.
Like, whatever, you know what I'm saying? Like Ferency's stuff would have come in through either Click or Murphy, because they all were working as a team together in terms of their investigation. Like, Click wrote, you know, kind of the Odin memo, you know, his little thing where mm-hmm. after they arrest Richard Allen, Todd Click is like, what the fuck just happened? And he's like sending McClelland an email saying, hey man, did you read that thing that I gave you, that 12-page investigation journal or memo that I prepared for you? Because I don't understand why you have this guy in custody when the evidence that we've been able to put together in terms of this other crew of people is way stronger. And I mean, so much so that Todd Click, who's a cop, goes and hires a lawyer to figure out, like, how do I deal with this prosecutor who I think is doing the wrong thing here. And, you know, so that's when this letter goes out to McClelland, and after Click, you know, talks to his lawyer and says, you know, how do I address this? What should I do with it? Because I think that they're fucking up. And, you know, from that point forward and right before trial, to follow on with the Todd Click story, you've got Ferency, who's killed. And that's after this Odinism thing has been going on in terms of their investigation. So whether there's a connection or not, I have no idea. But, you know, right before trial, Todd Click, who had left law enforcement and was working for like CPS or some branch of Child Protective Services, is arrested, saying that he was fudging his records, like right before the trial, on some bullshit, saying that he was talking to parents or witnesses on cases that were to be investigated, but he didn't really go, you know, or didn't make the phone call, or, you know, so like some ticky tacky shit that they come out in order to dirty him up before trial in the event that they're going to allow the third party culprit stuff to come in, you know.
You're right. And I remember that. Yeah, dude.
I mean, that shit's still pending for Todd Click. So, yeah. I mean, there was like an active, kind of an active, it seems to me, plan to dirty up everybody that was involved with that Odin side of it in order to be able to discredit it completely in the event that it would have come in at trial. And I mean, never forget that it was Judge Gull herself who told McClelland, hey, you know, Nick, you know, that whole third party culprit thing, you might want to go ahead and file a motion to try to bar that from being introduced. And McClelland's like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. So it's like, yeah, but this is all the shit that's going to be brought out in the brief. And it's just, to me, you know, for the girls, for those families of the girls, you want this thing to have been done right the first time. Yes. And I've been saying it forever and ever and ever. It just wasn't. And, you know, I don't know what the appellate court will do. I don't know what will happen if that is denied once the post-conviction petition is filed and that investigation takes place. Because that, the direct appeal, just so people understand, only deals with the issues related directly to the pretrial and the trial itself. You don't bring in new evidence there. Typically, in a direct appeal, it can happen, but typically you don't hammer away at ineffective assistance of counsel in that particular brief on a direct appeal. But that doesn't mean that it won't. That doesn't mean that it won't happen, because it can. It's just usually you see that in post-conviction work.
Here's the Delphi, the Bridge video, or one of them. Do we have, can we do sound on that, Todd?
Yeah, click, see what I can do. Click the sound thing down there, T, in the lower right-hand corner. It's muted. Okay. There you go.
Guys.
Hi.
Restart it. Here we go. Yeah.
See, this is the path that you're down.
I think she's talking to her. She's right there.
There's no path going there, so we have to go down here.
Pause it right there. So if you're to take Libby's words at face value, it sounds like they were already going down there.
Yeah, they're basically discussing mm-hmm. where the path is, where to go. Right,
before anybody says down the hill.
Yes, completely.
Right. She's talking about, like, this is the path that we have to take to go down. Yeah. Like, if nobody, like, it, and so as we're about to hear, this is when this person says down, like, so, yeah, it's just, I don't know, dude, this case is insane to me.
It is.
It doesn't feel weird at all when this resumes, because it's just, if these two girls are kind of like flailing around, like looking like they're anticipating to go down the hill, and you're walking by and they seem confused as to if this is a path or something, I would probably be like, oh yeah, down the hill, thinking nothing of it and continuing along my merry way. Let's play that last few seconds.
Guys. Hi.
There we go. It was just like, hi, down the hill. That's what I got out of it. Or, hey, guys, down the hill.
Yeah.
Nothing weird.
It doesn't seem strange. They just met somebody on the trail. They said hi. And then they continued about their business. It just doesn't feel like there's anything going on here.
Yeah, I mean, and there's people out there. Well, you know what I mean?
Riddle me this one. Why on earth is Bridge Guy the guy? What connects what this man on the bridge right? to magically being a murderer?
Yep.
Where did we find all the Bridge Guy clothes soaked in blood that we go, oh, well, it must be Bridge Guy who did this because the clothes he was wearing are covered in blood. It doesn't exist. It's simply because this guy was in the proximity of a murder, so was many other people who were walking around in that park that day. Any of them could be just as likely to have perpetrated this crime.
Yeah.
This idea that Bridge Guy is the guy, I've never understood. I just don't. How?
Yeah. I mean, to Stephon Curry's, that's a kidnapping when you pull a gun on kids and say, guys down the hill. Well, Stephon, I guess my pushback to you on that would be, how do you know he actually pulled a gun?
Yeah, we don't see it.
Because I completely reject. I can't remember who it was. If it was the cop that was listening to all the sound. One of.
Oh yeah, someone says they heard the gun.
Yeah, he says he heard.
There's leaves crunching. I don't know how you can make out distinct sounds.
There's no way. But he said not only that. That the gun's racked, but he also said that he thinks that he heard her say, "Dat be a gun."
Yeah, because she's suddenly speaking that way. She's suddenly speaking in a totally different cadence than she has in any other time. "Dat be a gun." Because that, like, come on, folks, common sense here. We don't even have a gun on video. We don't. The sound, because you heard a noise amongst a thousand other noises. Well, that one must be a gun racking.
It could be a twig breaking.
And somehow this man who's on the bridge amongst many other people in that park that day, on the nice day that it was, must be the murderer because they happened to capture him on video.
I mean, like,
the dots don't connect.
Well, they don't, but I can see why law enforcement took it that way, because it was the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, I mean,
they've got there. They get the phone. They get this video. They're like, oh, shit, there's the guy. Like, I mean, you can see why law enforcement decided to tunnel vision on that dude being the guy. Right. Because it was the easiest thing to do. And to them, it made the most sense.
It's quite a assumption, though, too.
I mean, it is.
If those girls had taken more videos, they could have captured probably many more people. And I think any one of them would have been just as likely as being the person. Mm-hmm. I mean, or less likely. Because if you see the person that has a camera and they're videoing you, you think, I'm going to go kill them and leave their phone by them that they just taped me on.
Right. Like, no, place it under her.
Yeah, and place it under her body. It's not like you missed the phone and you saw her with the phone and she might be taping you. Yeah, let's go kill those two and leave the phone there.
I'm obviously with you. I'm so ready for this appeal to, you know, the brief to get filed, man. To see
me too. Me too.
And just, you know, go.
There's a lot. I mean, if anything, all these pieces, these depositions that have come out really just reconfirm just what a cluster this whole thing has been that we've all known it to be, but even worse, I think, than we originally thought possible. Bob Mata, Defense Diaries, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your thoughts on this. And Buried, the John Wayne Gacy story, is that
Inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation.
Inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. It is available also wherever you get podcasts. Search for it right now. Buried inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. Multi-parts into it in ways that you have never heard this case before. So if you've been into the Peacock series, you definitely want to check this one out as a great companion to it. It's going to take you so much deeper than anything you could ever get on the series, but definitely worth
Thanks,
checking
T.
out from Bob.
Thanks.
So do check that out. Until next time, for Bob, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender, juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.